You've heard AM, you've heard FM. Now, tune in to DM Radio, the world's longest-running show about data. Each week, host Eric Cavanaugh interviews the brightest minds in the world of information management. Want to be on a show? Send an email to info@dmradio.biz. Now, here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
Gentlemen, hello and welcome back once again to DM Radio. Yes, indeed, my name is Eric Cavanaugh, your humble if excitable host for the show that is designed, after all, to peel away the marketing veneer, get down to brass tacks, and hopefully figure out what is going on in the field of information management. And the topic for today, let's face it, folks, it's a very, very hot topic across our industry and beyond, quite frankly. It's something all those investors are looking at, the VC companies, venture capitalists, vulture capitalists, as some folks would call them. They're not all like that, of course. Some are really nice people. But data science is what we're talking about today. Yes, driving business advantage with data science. We have an all-star cast lined up for you today. We're going to hear from Jeff Magnuson of Stitch Fix, Dr. Wayne Geary of MZ, Ashley Kramer of Alteryx, and Matt Denisick of Noodle.ai, all interested in the topic of data science. I'll throw out my quick 2 cents about this topic in general, and then we'll just dive right in with our guests. And of course, big thanks to Dataversity for their collaboration with DM Radio. Hop online to dataversity.net or dmradio.biz for more information. And you can always email me, info@dmradio.biz, or tweet with the hashtag of DM Radio. And data science, I've tracked this stuff for quite a while now, and I view data science as the assiduous execution of data management practices done for the benefit of some organization. So it's not just predictive analytics. It's not just artificial intelligence. All of the old practices really matter. Things like data quality, things like methodologies, things like schemas, for example, things like models that you design. All of these things come together. And if you practice them very carefully and in a repeatable fashion, that's a very critical point right there, then I would say you are in fact engaged in data science. So it's not just artificial intelligence or machine learning, for example. Those are component parts. But really the key is that repeatability. If you think about this, I've been on a soapbox for a while now on this topic. I think that many people hear the term science and what they think is it's an infallible representation of reality, and that's just not the case. Science is a discipline which is underpinned by a methodology, and if executed judiciously, it can reveal very useful things about nature, about the world around us, etc. So data science, I think, is the very careful execution of data management for some business benefit. And with that, let's go around the room. I guess I'll start out with Jeff Magnuson of Stitch Fix dialing in. He's got quite a job. Jeff, tell us a bit about yourself and what you do at Stitch Fix.
So I lead the algorithms, platform, and data infrastructure groups over at Stitch Fix. And for folks who aren't familiar with the company, Stitch Fix is a personal styling service. We serve men and women, plus sizes, and most recently, kids. We've been around for a while. We were founded in 2011, and we're led by our CEO and founder, Katrina Lake. A pretty decent-sized company. We employ about more than 5,800 people nationwide. And one of the things that gets me really excited to work here is that data science is absolutely a core part of the business. Out of our headquarters staff, we have 85-plus data scientists working for us. We're doing a lot of exciting stuff over here. To just kind of set some context into how Stitch Fix works, you sign up, you complete a fairly extensive style profile, and you schedule a fix. And so a fix is 5 items handpicked by a personal stylist who's armed with a styling algorithm that's an output of our data science group here. 5 items handpicked especially for you. We ship them to you. You try them on at home. You're able to keep what you love. You return what you don't. Shipping is, of course, on us both ways. One of the cool cool things about Citrix is it's truly a personal styling service, meaning that there's no search or filtering by our clients of the inventory over at Citrix. You're truly asking us to style for you, and so we're doing all of that for you. And so when we talk about data science over at Citrix publicly, we're most commonly known for our styling algorithms, which are the things that are assisting our personal stylists in making the optimal selections for our clients. But truly, we leverage data science in nearly every function at Citrix, and so it's pretty pervasive over here.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I have to say, you guys, I think, have really filled a wonderful gap, no pun intended, I guess, in terms of hitting the fashion industry and clothing, right? When you think of data science, a lot of people think of, things like security or issues like price optimization and so forth. But you've actually rolled out some very powerful data science algorithms to find the right styles for people. Can you kind of talk about how you're trying to enable your data scientists to take a self-service approach to setting up their infrastructure and getting the ball rolling?
Yeah, so, when I joined Stitch Fix, it was very early days, to create the data platform over here, and we hadn't figured out a lot of things at that point. And, as you pointed out, it's not the typical industry to be doing this in, and so both intriguing and kind of scary at the same time. We had to figure out a lot of this stuff for ourselves, and so in deciding how we were going to structure the team and the tooling, we had to optimize for that, which is the creation of new capabilities and ideas. And optimize for the velocity of making that happen. So we took a very self-service approach to our tooling and our infrastructure here, where we're able to empower our data scientists to drive ideas and processes all the way from conception and experimentation to implementation and eventually deployment of those data science capabilities into the business. So our data scientists, they have a seat at the table in deciding what product features we're going to build out, and then they're actually doing a lot of the implementation and the building of those algorithms and tools versus a lot of other popular approaches in industry where a data scientist is often cast as a thinker and not a doer. They might prototype and experiment, but oftentimes the results of those prototypes get handed off to an engineering team to implement or create integrations into the product with. And so we've kind of really set a lot of expectation on our data scientists to be a little more full stack and get their hands dirty from end to end and making those capabilities appear into the business.
Yeah, no, this is a really good point that you bring up, which is that if I understand correctly, you've set up an environment where the data scientist has the capacity to dive into whichever part of the problem needs to be addressed, but can also work with the team, right? Because I think one of the misconceptions about data science and data scientists in particular is that they are sort of these supercharged be-all, end-all individuals who can almost work magic with data. And I think in most environments, you actually have much more of a cross-functional team on the data science program. Is that right?
Right. We also have a little more engineering-oriented data scientists. And so, our data scientists are at least empowered to, create their own ETLs, so extract the data that they need. They're empowered to analyze it through our tooling and then, create models, algorithms, recommendation systems, and deploy them into production. But certainly, I think it was Josh Wills who tweeted a fairly well-known tweet at this point. It went something to the effect of data scientist is a better engineer than a statistician and a better statistician than an engineer. But the inverse of that is it implies that, you know, the data scientist is probably not a better engineer than an engineer. And so we certainly, you know, don't expect them to be. And so that is where my team comes into play to build, you know, the tooling that is self-service and guided enough for our data scientists to be autonomous in their ability to, you know, build models and deploy them, but, you know, not expect them to necessarily come out with implementations that are going to automatically scale or be adverse to any kind of like failures in infrastructure issues, right? And so creating that symbiotic relationship between the engineering team and the data scientist versus a relationship of like a handoff of a spec or a prototype is really where the tooling comes into play. So it's less of a cross-functional team necessarily working on every individual product, but you know, more of a striving to create levers from the engineering teams that our data scientists can be autonomous and tuning and optimizing for the business.
That's interesting. And I guess I'll throw one more question over at you before we bring in our next guest. I think I'll bring up Ashley Kramer of Alteryx next. In terms of building out the infrastructure and staying on top of those things, we are in the midst of a rather significant transformation, but it seems to ebb and flow. And where I'm going with this is we had these big data platforms that came out about 10 years ago, Cloudera, Hortonworks, MapR, these guys all focused on the Hadoop ecosystem, which has now been somewhat downplayed as people have figured out there are other ways of storing data more cheaply, and we realized that MapReduce wasn't the best mechanism for executing these algorithms. But so there seems to be this ebb and flow in terms of managing the infrastructure versus the applications and so forth. And if I hear you correctly, you've kind of focused on that part of the process, right, to be able to create a very robust and durable data infrastructure that allows data scientists to kind of play around in any way they want with the data and the various tools that are available to them. Is that right?
Right. I mean, one way that I like to think of it is, you know, we're constructing Lego blocks that our data scientists are assembling into, you know, algorithmic capabilities into the business. And it's my opinion that there's kind of two layers to the infrastructure. So there's infrastructure as a service, which is, you know, the cloud providers. So you've got GCE, AWS, Citrix is 100% deployed on AWS, and so we heavily utilize infrastructure as a service. Where we can, we'll utilize data infrastructure as a service. So, you know, for example, the EMR stands for Elastic MapReduce is an AWS service that we use to deploy our Spark clusters, which, you know, we're heavily invested in the Sparkiverse at Citrix. But then on top of that, you have more of an algorithms platform, which is where I try to get my team focused as much as possible. And that's, you know, building tools that are a little more business specific to allow the creation of those data science capabilities to happen with a lot more ease. So things like keeping track of the real-time state of our inventory or the set of inventory that's qualified for our clients for each warehouse. Lots of examples of capabilities that can be composed to create algorithms. And, you know, getting those right and getting those scalable and accessible in the ways that our data scientists are going to use them is kind of what I consider like the algorithms platform as a service. And that's a little harder to enter from a vendor space, I think, and to not have in-house at this point, just because a lot of the needs are very specific to the company.
Yeah, right. That's a really good point. Well, let's bring in Ashley Kramer from Alteryx, waiting back there in the wings. Welcome back to DM Radio. Tell us a bit about your thoughts on the data science front, and I know you mentioned some cool things in the pre-show, so tell us a bit about what Alteryx is doing these days and how you kind of fit into the data science space.
Yeah, hi, everybody. I'm Ashley Kramer. I'm Vice President of Product Management at Alteryx. And just for people that may not be familiar with Alteryx, we're an end-to-end analytics platform that really allows everybody in an organization, from an analyst that maybe doesn't code at all to a data scientist that spends their entire day doing that, to really come together, collaborate, and build a data-driven culture together. And so there's four key components to our platform. The first is what we call Connect, and that allows you to discover your content and collaborate around it. The second is our core product, which is Designer, and that allows you to prep, blend, analyze, and model in a code-free and code-friendly way. The next step is being able to scale and share the insights and the apps that you build within Designer in what we call Server. And then finally is something that we introduced earlier this year, which is all about deploying models instantly for real-time usage. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. And so we're building for three main trends when it comes to data science. And the first is there are simply not enough data scientists. There's not enough trained data scientists out there. And research has shown us that over the next 5 to 10 years, that's actually just going to get worse. And so what Alteryx is trying to do is we're really trying to help up-level the skills of those analysts that are already in our platform, able to, in a code-free way, prep and blend their data and get it ready for that next step of modeling. And so we're really trying to fill the gaps and create more people that can build models without having that official deep knowledge and PhD. And that is something that's sometimes known in the industry as the citizen data scientist. And that really actually allows the data scientists to focus on their important R&D efforts, and then the citizen data scientists can fill gaps and build things like churn models and sales forecasts. And so these groups both can work together and build different levels of models that really help drive the business forward. The second is for the data scientists to really be successful with what they're building, they, of course, need to get it into production. And Rexa Research has actually found that only 13% of data scientists say that their models always get deployed. And this is due to the complexity in deploying models. So the common way that it works is the data scientist builds their model in R or Python or Scala, and then they hand it over to developers to recode into PHP, .NET, or Java to get that into production. This is a pretty error-prone process. There's a lot of missteps that can happen. For instance, developers and data scientists don't always speak the same language, so it can get coded wrong. It also doesn't always fall as a priority for the developer who has to work on other things, like important features for their company. And so what we did by introducing Alteryx Promote earlier this year is we allow data scientists to take those powerful models as they are in R or Python or Scala, and we wrap it in what is known as a REST API, and get it into production for real-time usage instantly. So that really helps solve the problem of only 13% of those data scientists saying that those models are getting deployed. And then finally, we're really trying to help organizations solve how to bring everybody in an organization together, from the analyst to the citizen data scientist to the data scientist, and collaborate together. And the way that we try to achieve this and solve it is by allowing customers to come together in a code-free and code-friendly way. So what do I mean by that? I mean, if you're an analyst that doesn't understand how to code, you can drag and drop what we call tools, and you can start blending your data without ever writing a line of SQL or a line of any other code format. And then we also allow the data scientists to come in and put code into what we call code tools. And so now they're integrating with those analysts. The analysts don't need to understand the code, but it's all part of one end-to-end business process. So they're able to come together, build one business process, and break down these silos that we often see in organizations.
Yeah, those are a lot of really good points that you threw out there. And I guess we got about a minute and a half or so before the first break. Very quickly, to me, one of the biggest challenges is then once you've solved what you've just mapped out, which is significant, now you've got to map all that stuff to business processes. And increasingly, that is something you can do through APIs, these application program interfaces. Very quickly, in like 45 seconds, just give us some flavor of how you actually connect that to the business.
Well, we connect the processes back to the business. We allow the customers to then take this end-to-end flow that you can build within the platform and wrap it together as what we call either an analytic app or a macro. And then it's essentially you have this one graphical user interface that you can go and use, and you're utilizing that powerful, the machine learning or the powerful data science modeling on the backside, but you're able to extract value by simply dropping down, drag and drop, dropping down columns and bringing those answers to the forefront.
That's really cool stuff. All right, folks, we're talking all about data science today on DM Radio. Tweet with the hashtag of DM Radio or send me an email. We'll be right back in 2 minutes. Don't touch that dial. You are listening to DM Radio.
Rwanda is famous to many, not for the butchery of the old days, but now for how clean it is. There's a reason for that. Out of tragedy, a new duty. Next on Dan's Life.
Think you've got a good radio show idea? Gab Radio Network can help you with your podcast or radio show. Find out more by emailing sales@gabradionetwork.com. That's sales@gabradionetwork.com.
When I first think of a capital city in Africa like Nairobi in Kenya, Cairo in Egypt, the first thing I think of is the mountains of trash that aren't too far out of sight. But the fascinating nation of Rwanda, who much of us know only for the horrific images coming out of that civil war in the mid-90s, human carcasses littering the landscape as far as the eye can see, has come a long way. And perhaps the fresh memories of those events have led to this, called Umuganda. Every last Saturday of each month, the city of Kigali shuts down and the people come out to clean. In my neighborhood, it's usually the usual suspects we see on trash duty or cleanup patrol, but in Rwanda, like the obligation or not, it is the law that everyone pitch in to get the place spick and span. The word Umuganda is also an effort to right the wrongs of the past, because that was what forced labor was called before the Civil War, before things went fully off the rails, when the majority forced those deemed lesser than them to clean, to do the dirty work. Now, all tribal groups and ethnicities are involved. This kind of reconciliation and common purpose has seen Rwanda turn into one of the most industrious and investment-attracting countries in Africa, with a crime rate that is next to nothing. Imagine what San Francisco might be like if everyone, from the highest to the lowest, got out there and cleaned. For one, it would smell better.
Find out more about Dan's life on Facebook. Search at French and Friends.
But maybe that ethic is anathema to the American way of life. Maybe that's something we could learn from cultures we often consider lesser than ours. This is Dan's Life.
Welcome back to DM Radio. Here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, ladies and gentlemen out there in the world of data, here we are back on DM Radio. Your host, Eric Cavanaugh. All-star cast of guests today. We heard from Jeff Magnuson of Stitch Fix and Ashley Kramer of Alteryx. Next up, we have Matt Denisuk of Noodle.ai. You can find them online at Noodle.ai. The AI does, in fact, stand for artificial intelligence here. So, Matt, tell us a bit about yourself and what you guys are doing in the data science space.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Matt Denisuk. I'm actually a co-founder and the chief data science officer at Noodle.ai. Which we founded about 2.5 years ago, and I'll give a bit of background on what we do there. But just to give you a bit of background on myself, prior to co-founding Noodle, I was the chief data science officer at General Electric, and the general manager of their data science center of excellence, who did industrial programs across all of GE's businesses and aviation and power generation, transportation, healthcare, and so forth. And prior to that, I spent a lot of years in IBM research, largely doing smarter planet analytics in industrial areas, finance, accounting, CRM, human health, and also was a partner in their venture capital group for a number of years. A little bit about Noodle, .ai. We actually just completed our Series B round of financing, we're really stoked about that. What we are is what we call an enterprise and industrial artificial intelligence company, and we've got a set of products that are focused on core areas. Enterprise and industrial areas, largely focused around production or manufacturing and the logistics and inventory processes associated with those. So we have then teams of people in our company. I'll say a bit about them in a second, but we have our teams of people adapt and configure these products to deploy them on our what we call our BEAST platform. It's an acronym for the AI supercomputer and workbench that we have to develop and run these applications. So we deploy them on our BEAST platform and then run them for customers in an AI as a service model. So we maintain it. We usually charge a subscription fee of some type. And to do this, of course, and it's really one of, I think, we started the company on an observation that each of us had made over the years about the sort of low success rate of enterprise and industrial applications being deployed in a big way. And one of the key elements of the solution to that is to really bring together data scientists, data engineers, infrastructure engineers, software engineers, UX specialists, people that really understand the user and the you know, not just the UI, but the actual user, you know, workflows and the types of skills they have. And then very importantly, real deep business experts on the specific business problems that we're focusing. And that's both from the business stakeholder sense, but also from the real domain expert. For example, if you're doing manufacturing production of steel, which is actually one area we've done a lot of work in, you know, the people that really understand steel manufacturing as well as the business people running the mill, and bringing all those people together to really identify what the right problem is and making sure you have the right data and the right domain knowledge to let you get some advantages from things like transfer learning and end up being, we found, critical ingredients to making this work.
Yeah, no, you bring up a lot of good points there, and I guess what I'll try to stress here is that we do have this just wide range of technology and processes and business functionality that we're trying to enable, and I think that's why it is such a challenge. So to your point, you know, that business expertise is really, really important, because you need to have people who understand the nuances of a particular aspect of a company, and that's kind of rare, right? You don't get too many people who really understand the end-to-end processes of a business itself, and that's the kind of person you want working with a data science team. So I think I see why you've got a nice value add here. You come in with expertise on how to leverage algorithms to improve processes, and you have a lot of business expertise, people who can kind of serve as a liaison to the client to really tackle what that specific function is going to be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think it's one of the things that has sometimes held back progress in this area is kind of a bit of a confusion. I think it relates to kind of what you were saying before, a bit of a confusion about the AI that we see and how it applies and so forth. So I think, for example, most of the news we see about AI or data science even really relates to what I might call, you know, mature AI, which is, you know, things like image recognition, where you've got these massive databases of images all in the same format, fully labeled, and we've had some massive advantages, especially with, you know, with deep learning techniques and being able to do better image recognition, machine translation, where again there's massive sets of human translated docs, web pages, books, all that kind of stuff, and you can apply fully data driven techniques to do that really, really well. Self-driving cars, obviously, you know, the enormous excitement there, but you've got a case there where you've got, you know, the cars were specifically sensored up and designed to generate the data you need to do the AI, right? They're purpose generated. The data is there to do the AI, and there's billions of miles already driven in great simulators. So these are cases where you've got extremely well-defined technical problems, clear success measures, pretty massive investment levels. The business value is not even questioned, right? You know, people just work on it and expect to get incremental results, and there'll be funding for that. There's actually also huge research and engineering communities around each of these areas and conferences and journals and so forth. And they have that expectation of slow incremental improvements. And they get those, you know, by applying increasing amounts of the same kinds of data, adding to the computing power, and tweaking the algorithms. Now, the industrial enterprise problems we work with, I think, actually have tremendous fundamental differences from those kinds of problems. And so when people try to approach the enterprise problems in the same way they approach those problems, they run into problems, right? So you look at the kind of enterprise problems that we deal with, things like, you know, supply and demand management, right? So in this case, you have company-specific, very company-specific supply and operations planning processes and systems, very siloed data sets, inconsistent capture practices even within the same organization, and, you know, the absence of really key external data you need. You know, if you look at customer value optimization, you've got very company-specific CRM processes, very spotty data capture processes, often because people never anticipated doing AI with this, so they've thrown away all the historical data that you would need.
Oh,
and then
right.
In the industrial areas that we work in, industrial production, you know, very company-specific siloed processes, reactive data capture policies, they try to capture data when something goes wrong and see if they can figure out what it was. And they're stuck there, unlike the self-driving cars were, they're stuck with the sensors that were installed and decided to be put in long ago just for control purposes, right? And so in cases like this, you know, you've got technical problems that are not clearly linked to the business problems, right? Again, this is why you need that deep business expertise coming in, because just to define what business problem is most likely that you most likely have the data needed and the techniques available to solve it is a non-trivial question, right? Also, the investments in these areas, these business users are a bit skeptical of AI. Like, no one's skeptical of AI in image recognition or self-driving cars, but when you're talking about inventory management, people are skeptical of AI. So you have small investment amounts, and you have to show some concrete business value for these incremental investments. The research communities are pretty thin, so you don't have deep experts in these areas, pools of experts that you can go to hire. And what's really key, and I think this relates to the notion of what data science is, there really is an element of science to it, in the sense that until you've solved the problem, you don't know if the data that you have even have enough signal to solve the problem. So there is that element of hypothesis, reformulating the problem and so forth, to get it and solve it. And I think it's a very different process than the mature areas. And the objective we have as a company, through the model that we've developed, is to gradually pick a few problem areas within this set of problems and translate them and improve on them over time to make them like those more mature areas. And then we would start getting the kinds of characteristics they have, and also the kind of consistent improvements that they have.
Yeah, you made a really, really good point there, and I'll segue to our final guest here before the roundtable. But with science, if you are going to actually engage in real science, you need to forever question your data, your processes, your conclusions, your formulae, everything, because you know that you just don't know everything. And so even when you've solved the problem, that doesn't mean you solved everything about it or that you understood everything about it. It just means you had enough information to solve that particular problem. And I think our next guest knows a thing or two about that. Dr. Wayne Geary from MZ is dialed in from his office somewhere in Texas. So Dr. Geary, tell us a bit about MZ and how you guys are using data science.
MZ has been around since 2001, and we really do focus on getting people to the right location, and that's dealing with econometric data. We work with 200-plus economic development organizations. We're in working with 24 states. You'll find our data in the New York Times, Harvard Business Review, Forbes, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, et cetera. Brookings Institute uses our data. We deal with labor. So I've heard other speakers alluding to Ashley talked about the shortage of labor. Well, there is a shortage of tech labor, and a lot of companies will hire us to use our data to get them to the right location for the right fiscal and financial reasons. I do want to go back to the issue of the science component of this, too. With us, it is all about science. It's about scientific protocol. We have people who are strong in statistics, math, data engineering, machine learning, visualization, and GIS and spatial data. All of that is relevant to how we use data to get people to the right location. And there's the complexity of crosswalking the taxonomies of labor, not only here in the United States, but all over the world. And so when we're doing that contextual analysis and people are looking to site a new HQ, a call center, tech support, or manufacturing, they're looking for very specific people. There are general labor categories, and then there are more specifically skill-driven labor categories. So that's what we do.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really cool, I have to say. And I think that the timing is perfect for your type of service offering, because in this information economy, in this fully and deeply connected world, many jobs can be done from anywhere just by phoning it in or being on a computer somewhere. And part and parcel to all that, I think, is a need for real deep specialization these days, meaning if you want to be very successful, you have to specialize or be one heck of a good generalist. And it seems to me the service you're providing is facilitating the amplification of specialization. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we look at labor availability, the cost of labor, the sustainability of labor, the tech-savvy workforce, where is that located? And every single one of the 50 top tech companies are looking for that kind of labor, whether it's AI, cloud computing, animation, programmers with specific languages. We help locate the best location to get a sustainable workforce.
Yeah. So do you, your clients obviously are these companies that are looking to hire people. Do you also publish any of these results? Because I think some of that stuff would be really fascinating to read. And where I'm going with this is that there is this whole new array of job types and titles unfurling before our eyes because of the fact that we have such an interconnected world and there are so many new jobs like around social media marketing, for example, around analytics, around data and understanding data and mapping that back to business processes. I mean, do you, A, do you publish in that space at all? Or B, what can you share with us about the sort of changing nature of the job market?
Well, that's very true. And we do look at, we specifically recently looked at data scientists. And so we're crosswalking those skills for data scientists from the traditional titles that they held. Like it's not really good just looking for programmers. And is a programmer just the definition of data science? No, the definition is much more broad than that, and it's much deeper, and the skills are even broader than that. So we're linking, making those links, making the what's called crosswalks, and helping the federal government even understand what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. I think to a certain extent, the general public really does need to just bone up on some of these technologies and understand things, because it's almost like business people have to learn more IT and IT people have to learn more business these days. Would that be about right?
Well, I think I see that as an issue. Certainly, you've definitely, I've worked in a large real estate company where you have a big IT infrastructure, and then you've got business people on one side, and there's a huge gap, and money is being wasted because they're not linking the technology to the business process. And a lot of what
right.
real estate companies do, for example, is get people to the right location, and they need to understand technology and how it can facilitate that process.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, something we may want to dive into during the roundtable discussion that's just kind of popping into my head here is we are also in this rather massive migration now to the cloud. And what I mean by that is we have on-premise data centers all over the place. Lots of companies are still obviously running their own mini data centers, if you will, just their own network of computers. And that's all changing, and it's changing in very rapid and turbulent ways, it seems to me. You know, you look at, for example, Salesforce and the impact that it's had, but you look at Marketo, you look at even LinkedIn and these new social media networks, they're starting to provide functionality. I mean, I've seen this in my industry where there are companies that just sit on top of LinkedIn and manually and also dynamically crawl through the links out there and set up appointments for companies in a sort of lead generation way. So I guess my point is that there are all these ways in which cloud computing is now really starting to infiltrate business processes in both acute and very broad ways. And to me, that's another just significant component to understanding data science and how it works and being able to leverage all that stuff. Do you see this sort of migration to the cloud as an opportunity to talk to your clients and to get them to better understand how to use technology?
Yeah, I do. I mean, we're all of our technology sits in that kind of platform, and so we're not just solving problems. People are taking our data and solving problems as well, and so we're also using profile data from companies like LinkedIn and scraping about over a billion profiles and aggregating that data into a product to be able to help make a decision about global places to find labor. So the answer is yes.
Wow. Good stuff, good stuff. All right, folks, we're talking all about data science, the cloud, analytics, big data, all that fun stuff. Stick around, we'll be right back. You're listening to DM Radio.
Do you have a great idea for a radio show but have no idea where to start? Or have you been hosting a podcast for a while and want to take it to the next level? If so, you need the Gab Radio Network. To host a show on the Gab Radio Network, all you need is your voice, and we'll handle the rest. From technical engineering to full-service audio production and much more. Every show on the Gab Radio Network can be heard on our station on the TuneIn Radio app. Plus, we put all our shows on our satellite, which is accessed by 5,500 stations. And here's the best part. You can host from anywhere you want. There are many means to connect to the Gab Radio Network remotely, and our staff of highly trained engineers and producers will make you sound like you're right here in studio. So, if you want to be on the Gab Radio Network, the same network that hosts the Small Business Advocate, Radio MD, and Talkin' Pets, send an email right now to sales@gabradionetwork.com. That's sales@gabradionetwork.com. If you run a large corporation, small business, or anything in between, you need ads to help get the word out. A full page in the newspaper sounds good. A TV spot sounds even better. But let's face it, newspapers are essentially last-minute wrapping paper, and a TV spot is just expensive and basically code for bathroom break. Talk radio is different. Commercials cost practically nothing to produce, and the listeners are loyal. They like what they like, and they stay tuned in. When they hear about a new product or service during their favorite show, they can't wait to try it out for themselves so they can talk about it with their friends. And you know how radio listeners like to talk. If you want to add radio to your marketing portfolio, you need the Gab Radio Network. Gab Radio is the team of full-service experts you've been looking for, from writing to production, distribution, voiceover, and more. We make sure your spots are paired with the right shows in the right markets at the right time of day so the right people can hear. Since we're in over 100 markets across 34 states, Canada, and American Samoa, I'd say it's a pretty good place to start. If you want to know more, just email sales@gabradionetwork.com. That's sales@gabradionetwork.com.
Welcome back to DM Radio. Here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, folks, back here on DM Radio. Big shout out to our new fans out in Utah. We just got picked up by KYAH. So hello to all you folks out there. Drive time, Monday morning. Yes, indeed. We're now in 7 markets, by the way. I was doing the math earlier today. We're in California, Illinois, Utah, Nevada, Kentucky, Georgia, and Florida. I love it. We're rocking, folks. And back to the topic of data science, driving business advantage, we decided to tackle the cloud and how it's changing the whole space of data science. And it's in a lot of very, very significant ways, quite frankly. There are cloud platforms. Of course, Google just had their big Google Next show. They're talking a lot about AI and machine learning. And again, these are all component parts of data science. I would argue that the data science moniker really does refer to the end-to-end processes necessary for managing data efficiently for business value. But I'll throw it over to Matt Denisuk of Noodle.ai. How does the cloud change things from your perspective in terms of data science and the capabilities in helping your clients?
Yeah, well, it's really critical for from a few different perspectives. I think for us, of course, it's fundamentally critical because our business model is AI as a service, which really has as a key element that we are providing it as a software as a service application at the end of the day. So running in a cloud, whether it's our cloud or another cloud that we have to run in, and that we are making it easy for the customer to use it by maintaining the application, having it run properly, and even more important, relating I think directly to the fundamental characteristics of AI and data science, we want it to be a learning application. So that doesn't only mean that we want the models to continually improve and retrain themselves as we see how they're working. And some of that can be automated, so some of that you could do in an on-premise application, but a lot of it you can't, because a lot of it depends on how on actually making adjustments when you see things may not be working quite the way you thought they did. So it involves our people being able to work directly on that cloud application. And also not just the fundamental algorithms and models learning, but also you want the application to learn, right? Because a key element inhibiting deployment of a lot of AI-based applications is what I would call the UX issue or the workflow integration issue, where the application, there's just things wrong with either the way it presents information to people or the kinds of results from the models it's showing to them and when it's shown. So you want to be able to adapt all that based on how they're actually using it. Of course, cloud makes that a lot easier. Another fundamental important point is, you know, we have a global model. We have groups of people in India working, in the U.S., and elsewhere, and they have to work together. And so it's easier to do collaboration when you're working on a same cloud instance. So it's like we're all working on the same system. And as a final thing, too, sometimes there's issues about data leaving the country and whatnot, and so it's nice to have an environment that can accommodate that. That said, I think there's some challenges with cloud as well. Some customers, it varies a lot by industry and by country and by sometimes just individual company. Some people are still a bit nervous of the cloud. You know, we think you know that's clearly going away because, you know, cloud is showing improvements in all kind of areas related to security as well over on-premise systems. But, you know, sometimes that's just kind of an emotional issue for customers to get over.
Yeah, you packed a whole lot of commentary into a very small period of time there, and you're exactly right. Workflow is everything. And we kind of went from this hybrid cloud to the multi-cloud word over like a six-week period of time, it seems to me. And multi-cloud is going to be the future. So I'll throw that over to you, Ashley Kramer. How do you see this proliferation of cloud platforms and the acceptance by the enterprise that cloud is real and it's the way to go? How is that changing the data science space for you and your clients?
So this is an interesting topic for me because what I didn't mention earlier is that my previous career prior to joining Alteryx, I was head of cloud at Tableau Software, and prior to that I worked at Amazon. So I have a whole lot of thoughts here. I will try to not get them all out because we'll be here until tonight. But so the way I see it is what everybody knows, right? The cloud is more scalable, it's more flexible. And so what that really means, particularly for the data science space, is more and more data can be collected from more places. And now it's not always just being known as sitting behind the firewall as cold storage that nobody's ever going to do anything with. So with the introduction of sources like Snowflake, Amazon Redshift, Google BigQuery, you have a platform where you can really start extracting value, and it's in a pretty cheap way. I mean, people didn't store a ton of data back in the day because it got to be pretty expensive, and it also was a slow process. You wanted more server support. You had to go order one, wait for it to be rolled in and set up, pay IT to do it. So I see a lot of value starting from the initial step of any data science process, which is data. I want to touch a little bit on what you mentioned about hybrid. So here at Alteryx, we are seeing both the hybrid and the multi-cloud. Customers are moving to the cloud at their own pace, and I believe it's really important for technologies to support that and not force them one way or the other. So we are seeing both cases where we're seeing people have data in legacy databases on premises and the cloud. And so what we're trying to do at Alteryx is be this seamless way that they can bring it all together and build those models, whether it is in the cloud environment version or on premises, and then also support this multi-cloud scenario that we're starting to really see emerge. And I think that's mostly because customers are going with the best-in-breed technologies and the different, as I'll call them, kings of cloud platforms have different offerings. And I think also we saw a lot in the past with a lot of data being locked into specific database vendor technologies. And so I think a lot of customers are trying to go with this more multi-cloud approach because they don't want to create that vendor lock-in. So it's really an important use case that we see amongst our Alteryx platform, which is being able to pull from all of these places and then do your robust modeling, make better predictions, do more classification because you're pulling data from different places, you're scaling it, and you're driving better outcomes.
Yeah, that's all good stuff. I think you're exactly right, too. And there is this lock-in reality. Some of it is intentional. Some of it is just, I think, baked into how we used to think when we designed software, quite frankly. But multi-cloud is the future. And I'm seeing more and more companies focus on serving as that sort of abstraction layer that sits between cloud environments and on-premises environments that lets you manage from one area, the so-called single pane of glass. But that's also very complicated. It's a very diverse and heterogeneous and thus topographically challenging world out there, at least from a data management perspective. So it does pay to focus your attention where it needs to be. And with that, I'll bring back Dr. Wayne Geary from EMSI. I have to think the cloud is a wonderful thing for you folks, right? Because it allows you to access data from all sorts of different sources. And do you actually set up connectors to these environments, or are you kind of pulling data down in batches and then reconciling it with your existing data?
No. We definitely want to automate this process and have connectors, these interconnections in place. I mean, with 1 billion data points just from one source, as you can imagine. And then you have different types of data, right? You have geographical data, which is spatially driven. You have tools to process that, and then size and format. And then, you know, we're reducing costs, saving time, and gaining insight much more quickly. So it's extremely valuable.
Yeah, that's just great stuff. And this is, it's funny because I had this idea, I wasn't the only one, about 2.5 years ago or so to create what I was calling a jobs data lake. And the idea would be that you'd pull from the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, but also from jobs boards and really any mechanism you could find to be able to piece together and get a relatively comprehensive view of what the jobs market looks like. Because it's very dynamic these days. It's changing very, very quickly, and there is no single source of truth. So you really do have to get this amalgam of different sources and then, of course, normalize that data to get a decently clear view of that. And that's kind of what you guys are doing, right? You're pulling from all these different sources, and I'm sure you've got some protocols you've developed for deduping and so forth and really getting that clear strategic view of who is where and who needs to be where. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and this is where I think scientific protocol is very important. And we've talked about it a number of times through this call today. And our clients are asking for that. I mean, what is the validity and reliability of what you're showing us here? Where is all this? Where are all these sources? What is the methodology that you use? It's all really important because they can't afford to make a mistake when they go to start up to locate a new headquarters like Amazon is doing, or a new manufacturing facility over in China. So those, you know, that's where big data helps, and being able to process these things with a level of validity and reliability.
Yeah, that's great stuff. And last but not least, Jeff Magnuson has been waiting in the wings patiently of Stitch Fix. You know, the cloud obviously is a great resource for you folks for number crunching, I'm just guessing, and for data. What about for understanding styles, or what can you tell us about how you guys use the cloud?
Sure. So in previous lives, I've worked in on-prem deployment, and, you know, more recently at Netflix and Stitch Fix in the cloud. And I think, you know, there's really kind of two significant advantages to being on a cloud deployment, and one is just around flexibility. So cloud providers have introduced this idea of storage as a service. Amazon has S3. Google has GFS. What that does is it decouples storage from compute, and so that allows us to employ any of a variety of technologies to read that data, process it, and to do it massively in parallel. So, if we have a new idea that we want to try out, we can spin up a new technology against it. Hundreds of machines to read that data, learn something about it, and then send them down to not have to pay for them constantly running.
That is amazing stuff. Well, folks, wonderful lineup of guests today. Check us out soon, all the time online. It's DM Radio.
If you run a large corporation, small business, or anything in between, you need ads to help get the word out. A full page in the newspaper sounds good. A TV spot sounds even better. But let's face it, newspapers are essentially last-minute wrapping paper, and a TV spot is just expensive and basically code for bathroom break. Talk radio is different. Commercials cost practically nothing to produce, and the listeners are loyal. They like what they like, and they stay tuned in. When they hear about a new product or service during their favorite show, they can't wait to try it out for themselves so they can talk about it with their friends. And you know how radio listeners like to talk.
If you want to add radio to your marketing portfolio, you need the Gab Radio Network. Gab Radio is the team of full-service experts you've been looking for, from writing to production, distribution, voiceover, and more. We make sure your spots are paired with the right shows in the right markets at the right time of day so the right people can hear. Since we're in over 100 markets across 34 states, Canada, and American Samoa, I'd say it's a pretty good place to start. If you want to know more, just email sales at gabradionetwork.com. That's sales at gabradionetwork.com.
This is GAB1, GABRadioNetwork.com.